evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. And for the last 29 and a half years on Sunday evenings, a group of enthusiastic, curious amateur radio operators get together and discuss something on the TechNet. The subjects are any subject of interest to ham radio operators. And I, along with some aid from John, KC2WGB, we try to organize this, these meetings where during the first hour we try to make a sincere effort that people who sign in and give us their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means they do have a question or a comment for the net, would make a sincere effort to at least give a brief answer during the first hour. At the end of that hour, at around 9 o'clock, John goes to the Mel's mailbag, as we used to call it, K2KEY, was the man who did that service that now John is doing, where those who don't, let me drop it, those who don't yet have their ham license or don't yet have a way of signing into the TechNet get a chance to ask their questions, particularly guys that are beginners, people studying for the exam. So we take two or three of those. And then Paul, the WS2N, our space expert, will tell us what's been going on with NASA. And lately it's SpaceX and Falcon 9, a brand new commercial service, had its big success this year. Also, astronomically speaking, you got something to look forward to, where there's an eclipse of the moon, which we can't see. I think it's on Monday night. Tuesday evening, because we're so far to the east of the event, we're not going to be able to really see it. But once per 110 years, roughly, or twice per 110 years, but the two episodes, 8 years apart, Venus crosses in front of the sun. And so for those who are at all astronomically inclined, that event occurs Tuesday evening near sunset. The event begins then, and we only get a chance to see the first 20 or 30% of it. Unfortunately, there's no guarantee that we'll have good, clear weather on Tuesday evening to see this. And it will also be, as the sun is setting, you'll be looking through the atmosphere at a grazing angle, so you won't get a really great view of it if you've got a real good telescope. For people who subscribe to things like Sky and Telescope magazine, the major telescopes around the world will be showing us pictures of what it's like with Venus crossing in front of the sun. That was a very important historical event when it occurred in past centuries, because it allowed astronomers to, for the first time, figure out what is the diameter of our solar system by using the timing of the crossing of Venus in front of the sun. With the right kind of geometry, you can figure out how far is the Earth from the Sun and how far is Venus from both Sun and Earth. So that was determined by that means. That's the method by which we figured out the 93 million miles between the Sun and Earth. Okay, we're going to take check-ins this time. You need not check in if you're just listening. After 29 years, we believe people are listening. So give John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes. A typical sign-in would sound like this, KD2BHY, Jim, and yes. So give me your check-ins right now, K2RIW.
KA2HTV, yes.
And Mr. HTV, you didn't tell me your name, sir.
Apologize, sir, the name is Dave.
Very fine, Dave. I should know that, but I don't. All right, we got Dave so far. Also, we've got a flea market we'll be discussing that took place today at Briarcliff College, and some people, are, I'm sure, got some real good goodies. We'll be hearing about that. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name this time.
E2BHY, yes.
Never heard of him. That's probably Jim. Okay, we've got Dave and Jim so far. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KT2CGK, Dan.
Okay, I think that's Kilo Bravo 2, Charlie Golf Kilo, named Dan. Is that true, Dan?
Correct.
Okay, glad you gave it nice and slow. All righty, once again, we got Dave, Jim, and Dan. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WS2N, Paul, with a space report, of course. Good evening, Dan.
Hey, did anything happen this week? That was a joke. Okay, one last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Hello, Echo 2, Quebec Romeo, Fred.
Okay, Kilo Echo 2, Quebec Romeo, Fred, we got you. Okay, you're the fourth on the list. Alrighty, let's start off with Dave first, KA2, Hotel Tango Victor. You got it, Dave.
Thank you. My question is actually very simple. When I work DX, I'm told that beam headings are given in degrees. For example, if I want to work Europe at 55 degrees. My question is, when I turn my beam and I set my rotor, is that a geographic, a magnetic, or a true direction? Now, I know there's a difference in our area of about 12 degrees between true north and magnetic north. So when I'm aiming my Yagi towards Europe, am I aiming it towards a true north, a true, or a corrected number?
Good question, Dave. And when it comes to maps, globes, beam headings, setting up two-way communication circuits and whatever, 99% of the time, that is true geographic setting, geodetic, geographic, in other words, that which the U.S. Geologic Survey uses. That's the true north that's used for those beam headings. The one group of people who still use magnetic are the aircraft people, the FAA. All of those numbers that are marked on the runways of all those airports are magnetic numbers. If you see the number 14 on a runway, that means 140 degrees magnetic, not true. So that's the reason they do that is because the main thing that you can trust in the instrument panel of an aircraft is a magnetic compass. It always, in theory, reads true. So your magnetic compass will read 140 degrees when you're lined up with that particular runway that's got the number 14 on it. So they're magnetic. Everybody else is geodetic, geologic, what you see on a map. True north is your heading. And 12.5 degrees or so is the magnetic deviation in our area. And here's a great question for you, Dave, and it's not an easy one. You'd be amazed. One-third of the guys will get this one wrong. If my compass reads 130 degrees in this area, what do you think is the true heading? If I got my hand pointed in the direction, a particular direction, and the compass is reading 130, what do you think is the true reading? Over to you, Dave. KQRIW.
The true reading should be 118.
Now you know why I asked the question. The true reading in that case would be 142. Magnetic readings are more to the counterclockwise. If I'm looking at the Earth's top view, magnetic north is to the left of real north. And therefore, let's see, now do I have this right? Ooh, I might have it backwards. Yes, I have it backwards. Give that man a cigar. Dave, you're right. You've got it in the right direction. You've been studying this. And so you're now making yourself a list of all the beam headings of all the countries you want to work when you're working DX. And how sharp is the beam on that antenna you're using, Dave? KE2HTV, KQRAW.
If the half-power beam width was, I guess, on a trail in Miyagi, be approximately 30 degrees. That sounds like the right number. I'm not sure, but... So that's really answering my question. So when I take my compass and I'm pointing due north, okay, I'm really pointing at 348 degrees. So technically, I have to... That true north reading is 348 degrees, approximately. I guess the conversion is 12, 13 around here, so... See, because I bet a lot of people knew that.
Now, bear in mind, you've also got to be careful when you're using a magnetic compass. If it's a properly compensating magnetic compass on an aircraft, and you're up in the air, no problem. When you and I go walking around our property, if you stand within, let me pick a number, 8 feet of your great big steel radio tower, you stand within 10 feet of your great big chunk of steel called automobile, those magnetic lines of force get distorted tremendous amounts, like 10, 15 degrees, 20 degrees at times, when you're anywhere near any magnetic object. So you've got to stand in the middle of a field somewhere, far away from all other chunks of ferromagnetic material, in order to take that compass reading. So it's very delicate along those lines, and a lot of people don't know that. the guys who do really precise aiming, the guys who are on 10 gigs on top of mountains, and you you know you're on top of Mount Wachusett in Massachusetts, you're going to talk to somebody on top of Mount Equinox in Vermont, and you know the exact beam heading, and you say to yourself, how do I know on this mountain where the hell that beam heading is? And the one thing you can really trust is the sun. They got a computer program that tells them at this hour of this day, at this location, the sun will be at 190 degrees. You aim the antenna at the sun, and even you can make, on 10 gigs, you can go for even greater accuracy. You aim for the maximum noise of the sun when you aim the dish at the sun. And then you set your Polaris, the compass rose, so to speak, that's on your tripod. You set that at 190, and from there on, you know where everything is. So there's all kinds of fancy ways of finding out where true north is, and it's kind of fun. And do you have any idea why, when you look at a flat map and you figure out that, gee, I'm at the exact same latitude as, well, let's say, London, why isn't London due east? Why do I have to aim to the northeast to get to London? You'd be amazed how many people have trouble with that one. K2H...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
K2HTV, K2RW, wait for the beep, you got it, Dave.
Well, I guess if you look at the map on a globe, it makes perfect sense. When you look at it with a flat map, you have to realize curvature of the Earth. It's very hard to picture that, but if you have a globe and you put the directly from New York to London, it's very obvious.
You got it, Dave. You stretch a string from New York to London on your globe, and you'll see why a great circle path is very different. You could be talking to somebody in Europe that's at the exact same latitude you're at, and your brain would say, gee, he's due east of me. Well, if you're going to fly along a line of constant latitude, which is in itself kind of a curved path, and it's not the shortest path, the so-called great circle path is... that where that string goes between New York and London on your globe. Another really crazy thing of the mathematics of it all is that the beam heading from New York to London and the beam heading from London back to New York are not 180 degrees apart. There's something very different than that. Great circle spherical trigonometry really behaves in funny ways. And you can get the extreme example of that is assume you're on the Arctic Circle, and you're talking to somebody in Russia who's due north of you. In other words, the signal goes over the North Pole, down the other side of the Arctic Circle and into Russia. You're aiming due north to get to the guy in Russia. The guy in Russia aims his signal back to you, also due north, over the North Pole and back to you, so to speak. Those two beam headings are not 180 degrees apart. They're 0 degrees apart. So as you get closer and closer to the North Pole or the South Pole, the mathematics of spherical trigonometry gets crazier and crazier. Good luck with that project, and are you heading for DXCC on your final, Dave? KA2HTV, K2RIW?
Actually, no. I have enough cars for DXCC times 10, but I recently had a rotor malfunction. I'm going to have to get it fixed, and when I put it back, I'm going to have to calibrate it accordingly. Now, luckily, it's very easy now because every iPhone has a map as a compass in it, so it's pretty easy to do. Again, you have to compensate for the tower, which in my case is aluminum. That's a whole separate story. Correction factor, which no one, my many years of DXing ever really discussed or spoke about in length. Yeah, it's very interesting the way you travel, like many of the paths that you have to shoot over the pole. For example, we're near the pole, within 30 degrees of the pole, such as China, Japan, Philippines, Singapore. And actually, Singapore, for example, is directly over circle. So zero.
Yeah, for a whole bunch of crazy reasons, the ionosphere near the pole behaves very differently than it does where you and I live. You also have the aurora borealis, and it is another ionized layer that your signal has to go through, which in many cases can give enhancement, or in many cases can give attenuation. I've talked to people on 432 who are in places like Michigan and Wisconsin by bouncing the 432 signal bounce off the aurora. And not many people know that the bounce off the aurora can get as high as 432 megacycles. 1296 is just about out of the question. The guys on 6 meters hear aurora signals all the time. They know that it's got a funny characteristic signal, and everybody aims their antenna north, and everybody in the United States, in theory, talks to each other when there's a good aurora curtain going on. Bye-bye for now, Dave, and see you down the line. Jim, KD2BHY, the guy who's trying to use as many of the 25 different kinds of ham radio in the next year as possible. What's the latest one you're seeking, Jim? KD2BHY? K2RIW.
Actually, Dick, today I want to ask a question about, first of all, VHF propagation, and then VHF packet and VHF digital. I've heard in many places through the ARRL and other stuff that if you increase your VHF power, that you will get farther range. But what I don't understand is that even though I can use a 5-watt radio with a beam to contact sites which are much farther than the line of sight, and I'm only using 5 watts. So technically, couldn't I use 5 watts, and wouldn't that just use line of sight? And if I increase power, how could it go further? Would there be propagation in there? I'm not sure.
It's a little bit similar to what happens with your coax cable, Jim. If I'm on VHF, like 2 meters, using a fairly small diameter cable, like RG58U, and if I was using it way up at 432 megacycles, and I had 100 feet of it, the signal going down the cable, I put 100 watts into one end, and you look up the right charts, you'll find out a 100-foot long piece of RG58 at 432, it's got something like 14 decibels of loss. Let's make it 13 decibels. It's a nice round number that I know how to calculate. 13 decibels, and by the way cable works, the loss is proportional to length in decibels. Kind of crazy. It's really a kind of logarithmic thing, but it's really in decibels. Every time you double the length of the coax cable, you get twice the number of decibels. So if I had 14 feet and 30 dB of loss for the first 100 feet, and I added another 100 feet, I'd have 13 plus 13, 26 dB of loss. 13 decibels, if you convert the decibels back to a real number, it happens to be a ratio of 20 to 1. In other words, if I put 20 watts into the cable in the shack, I'm only going to get 1 watt at the antenna in that example. So once you know the decibels of loss, you know how much signal is going to get through that particular path. Well, that's a one-dimensional path inside of a coax cable. In the case of radio propagation, depending on what Mother Nature is doing today, let me drop. There's some number of decibels of loss between you and the guy you want to talk to on, let's see, on 2 meters on single sideband. You want to talk to your buddy in Philadelphia. And I'm going to round off the numbers and assume Philadelphia is 250 airline miles from you. 200 by airline miles. I could be very wrong, but you know what I mean. 200 miles on that particular day. You could, in theory, have the guy use good instrumentation in Philadelphia when you transmit a known number of watts on Long Island, and he measures how much signal he gets. You go through the calculation, you find out how many decibels of loss due to what Mother Nature is doing in the ionosphere and the atmosphere between you and your buddy in Philadelphia. And then you want to talk to the guy in Pittsburgh, which is a lot further away. You do a similar experiment. You find out that Pittsburgh, if the guy between you and Philadelphia had 100 decibels of loss, and between you and Pittsburgh, maybe it's 150 decibels of loss. In order for that signal to get to Pittsburgh, which has got a greater amount of loss, you've got to transmit more power, otherwise the signal doesn't get to him above threshold. The signal is always getting there, but if the signal is weaker than his receiver can tolerate, he's not going to hear you. So greater path in general has more loss. The only way you can overcome more loss is to use more effective radiated power. Either you're going to use more real power out of the transmitter, or you're going to use higher antenna gain, or you can use an antenna that's higher up, which lowers the insertion loss somewhat. There's various things you can do. So, in the bottom line, how many watts I transmit through the cable tells me how many feet of cable I can go through and still get something at the other end, so to speak. That's above some number I need at the antenna. And by the same token, more watts gives you greater range in general. Now, let me drop this. There is an FCC rule that says you shouldn't use any more power than you need for that particular contact. And if you're on the crowded 20-meter band on a Saturday afternoon, it's a very good rule. I mean, if you're talking to a guy in the very next town, and you want to decide to have a conversation on 20 meters, and what you think is a quiet region of 20 meters, quite possibly 1 watt on both ends will do it. And if you both got a kilowatt transmitter, you're blasting away at each other, pounding each guy's signal transmitter, beyond the peg on the right-hand side in both cases, burning up a whole lot of power, so to speak, doesn't really change the quality of the contact between you and your buddy in the next town. But everybody else on the band is now hearing these very strong signals, and at great distances, they can no longer use that frequency. Well, maybe they could. So on HF frequencies that are crowded, that rule of using the minimum power makes some sense. You get up to 432, which is the wide open spaces. That band is 30 megacycles wide. The chances of you being on top of another guy where he couldn't just QSY, move his frequency a little bit, is no problem. So for you to run full power on 432, even though you're only talking to a guy a town away, pretty soon when you finish that QSO, somebody else who heard your great big strong signal a long distance away, he breaks in and says, gee, I've been hearing that contact. I want to talk to you. So on the higher frequencies, using the higher power allows more people to know you're there. I know you got a couple other questions. Go ahead, Jim. KD2BHY, K2RAW.
I do have one more question. Lately I've been getting very interested in VHF SSB and VHF DW and VHF propagation and weak signal stuff on VHF UHF frequencies. And since my HF is going so well, and I'm piling some, I'm getting some good equipment for HF, and everyone's been so generous for HF, I was wondering if how expensive would it be to get into VHF weak signal stuff? I have a correct antenna, and I don't have the correct coax, but I figure I could just run to Radio Shack and get that. But is it
Jim, you stopped mid-sentence very abruptly. I wonder, did the rig flip to another frequency? Did the battery go dead? Are you still there, Jim? Yeah, maybe Jim's battery went dead, or maybe he pressed a button by mistake and flipped to another frequency. I'm going to stand by for a second. KD2BHY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Dick, I'm here. I'm sorry my HT was low on battery, but if you could just give me a quick answer on that before my battery goes dead. How expensive would it be to get into VHF weak signal stuff?
Yeah, when you got a low battery, you'll discover that on a handy talkie, the battery, you probably draw a quarter of an ampere or half an ampere when you're transmitting. When you're receiving with low audio volume, you're only drawing a few milliamperes. So even with a dead battery, you can receive quite often for another half hour or another hour. So I don't have to talk fast. When you're transmitting, you got to talk fast when the battery is near dead. Now, getting on VHF, it's sort of like saying, hey, I want to drive an automobile. How expensive will it be? You can buy a used automobile that is a real fixer-upper, and maybe you can buy it for $100, or you can go out and buy a Mercedes-Benz for $100,000. So there's a lot of range. In the case of used VHF equipment, if, for instance, you want a 2-meter single sideband, one of my favorite rigs, you guys have heard me say it for many years, is an oldie but goodie. I think it was a 1990 vintage rig, Kenwood TS-711A, TS-711A. It's got a built-in power supply. It's got a completely variable output from 0 to 30 watts. It's got single sideband, CW, FM. It doesn't have AM, but it's got essentially all modes of operation. It's a desktop box, not a portable box. But because it is such a good one, it's got the world's best synthesizer. It's got an awful lot of nice functions in it and a built-in power supply. It's a very handy rig to start off on VHF. And because it's 20 or 30 years old, there are times when that particular rig will sell for numbers like $150 used in good condition. And even if it's not in good condition, there's ways of fixing it up. So with used equipment, carefully chosen, the right brand name and the right model number, $150 will transmitter-wise get you on the air. The antenna can be homebrewed. out of coat hanger wire or out of the rulers, you know, the yellow or expandable ruler, carpenter's ruler, and got brought to your attention that particular article.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So that carpenter ruler antenna, inexpensively you can build the antenna. In the beginning you can use Armstrong rotation before you own a rotator. The cable, there are various people who will probably give you or borrow, loan you a piece of good coax cable operational on 2 meters. They'll go from your shack to the antenna. So as cheap as $150, $200 or so, you could be on single sideband. If you want to get the latest and greatest, a Kenwood 2000, for instance, another all-mode rig of approximately the same power output, also made by Kenwood, that's got digital signal processing and a few other doodads in there, I think that rig brand new is $2,500. If you listen to the Kenwood 2000, a guy transmitting to you with a Kenwood 2000, another guy transmitting to you with a Kenwood 711 on single sideband, you would not be able to tell the difference, except that maybe the quality of the audio on the older rig might be a little bit better. I like the speech processor they've got in there, which has got a button on the front panel where you can turn the speech processor on and off. So that's just an opinion. That's the rig you're listening to right now, by the way, that I've been using for lots and lots of years. In fact, I got two of them. For a short period of time, I had three of them. So it can be done inexpensively. And for a guy with your enthusiasm, let me drop. The single sideband VHF frequency are a different breed. They're a little bit more experimental, a little bit more technically oriented, and I think you'll like them. And do both. In other words, talk to the guys, the so-called appliance operators on 2-meter FM, the ones you're talking to right now, as well as the more progressive guys on 2-meter single sideband. Slightly different antenna, horizontal polarized is the sideband people, vertically polarized is the other, and you can use the wrong antenna on the wrong polarization temporarily, but you'll get a little bit of better performance when you get the right one. For those who are listening to me, you might also know that there is a picture of Jim in the April or May issue of the Larkfield Amateur Radio Club newsletter, QTC. There's a picture of Jim there, and so we now know what you look like, Jim. For any final you want to transmit, go right ahead. KD2BHY, K2RAW. And maybe Jim's battery went all the way dead. If not, we'll pick him up a little bit later. Dan's the next guy who checked in there. Kilo Bravo 2, Charlie Golf Kilo, if I got it right. You got it, Dan. K2RIW.
Yeah, you're correct, look. Just the first of on the air. I got my lucky yesterday. And working with the Wilson with the Diamond Tenor helicopter. Over.
We're copying you very well, Dan. I think you said you just got your license yesterday. Congratulations. I'm a little bit amazed that your license is Kilo Bravo 2, and it's a brand new license yesterday. Most of the brand new licenses are Kilo Charlie and Kilo Delta, if you know what I mean. They've used up all the Kilo Bravos. But I guess after a certain period of time, they do reissue some of the older ones that have stopped being used. So maybe that's what's happening. I wonder if you've got a question, Dan. You sound real good. And why don't you tell us what kind of a rig you're using? KB2CGK, K2RIW.
No, it's Kilo Delta. Golf Kilo. We're working with Boston with the Diamond Antenna. Oh, fuck.
Now that makes a lot more sense, Dan. Kilo Delta. Okay, you are one of the very new sets of call letters. And that Boxman is sounding good. And I think you said what kind of an antenna you're using. Is it the built-in rubber duck antenna? And even if it is, when it comes to getting better coverage for a longer range, you could eventually build yourself a homebrew antenna out of coat hanger wire or various other ways like that. You find the right website article with a dollar's worth of materials, you could build a homebrew ground plane antenna mounted somewhere high in your house, in the attic, the highest room of the house, the chimney of the house outside. and a piece of cable coming down into the shack, and you connect that to where the antenna goes. With the antenna that's got outdoor exposure and higher altitude, your signal will get a hell of a lot stronger. You'll be able to run your watch then at the low power level and talk to repeaters much further away and not use up the battery as fast. So that's one of the things you could do later on. Not many people do, but the few who do that, they usually find out they get a lot better performance. So back to you, Dan. KD2CGK, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, nice to meet you. We're going to try and hook up an antenna on a roof. We presently are in an apartment building, and can't have anything too big, so we will get a dime to the outside. We're going to dime an antenna right now. It's a 16-inch dime. KD2CGK. Thank you.
I think you said you're using a 6-inch diamond antenna. And where's that diamond antenna located? Is it screwed directly into the transmitter? Or is it in the shack with you? Where is the diamond antenna located, Dan? Go ahead.
The antenna itself is located right on the radio. It's 16 inches. And we're outdoors right now in the mobile. She's sitting in the park. We're in Forest Park right now. QCH is on Max Pond and Leavitt, if you know where that is. We're not too far from Al.
Okay, a 16-inch antenna. It's probably a whip-like antenna. But at some later time, you may decide to make a second antenna, buy or build, homebrew. And as you locate it at your home, even though it's an apartment building, if you locate it at the window and then run a piece of cable from the window back to where you like to do the operating from, the closer you get the antenna to outdoor exposure and the higher you get it in altitude, the better will be the performance. You don't have to do that, but you'll be able to talk to more repeaters at a greater range when you do that. And then most rigs will have a way of disconnecting the antenna, and with the right kind of adapter, you plug in the cable, and the coax cable goes over to the antenna that's at the better location, and therefore it'll be as much fun as at home as it is when you're in the park where you are right now. So good luck with that project, and let us know how that goes. Check in the future, and tell us what changes you've made, Dan. The next person on the list was Fred, KE2 Quebec Romeo, if I got it right. Go right ahead, Fred, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. I'm just here listening, enjoying the TechNet, as I usually do, and I just wanted to check in this time, but I've been a good listener and a voyeur of the TechNet for years. So back to you guys, and carry on from KE2QR.
Very fine, Fred. Sounds like we got another happy customer there, John. I have to send him a bill. But that's a joke, Fred. Don't get worried. There was a good-sized flea market today at Briarcliff College. Of all the guys that are now sleeping it off, some of them maybe have come back to work, back awake. So anybody who was at the flea market and wants to describe what it was like, how many vendors, whether or not there was food. I think it was a little bit of a problem in the beginning as the food vendor maybe wasn't available. What did you buy? What did you see? What was the good deal that got away from you? So anybody who was at the flea market that wants to describe it to us, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
And thanks, Jim.
Go right ahead, Wes. And what did you see at that flea market? And did you almost buy something and then change your mind because the guy was giving you a tough time? I'm having a little fun with Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yes, they did. the guy was rude to me. I spent so much money with him, but he was talking nothing about it. Yeah, I bought a lot of stuff. One of the things that I would like to ask you a question is ballistic meter, two dots in beautiful letter box, and when I open up it's in pristine condition, but it says milliamp seconds. If you would like to comment on it. Now what it says on it is a plus minus, no, I'm sorry, plus 10, 30, 100, and 300. Back to you.
Yeah, what you've got is a fairly older instrument. I guess is it's in the old days it used to be in a wooden box with green felt on the inside. Later on, I guess the actual item itself was in Bakelite, but that's called a ballistic galvanometer. In other words, when you apply current to a meter and it starts moving up range, because the needle movement has a certain amount of mass to it, it doesn't move instantaneously. A ballistic galvanometer allows you to measure the product of milliamps and seconds. If I gave it 10 milliamps for 1 second or 1 milliamp for 10 seconds, in theory, you would get the exact same amount of motion of the meter. Back in the days when they didn't have good oscilloscopes, where you couldn't measure the voltage or current waveform and display it on a cathode ray tube, once you're using an oscilloscope, you can see the exact waveform of the current or voltage that your circuit is generating or using, and you can integrate by eye or with your pencil and make yourself a graph off the screen or take a photograph. You can figure out the amount of area under the curve of milliamps and time. If I was producing positive going square waves, you know, maybe I'm producing radar pulses. Let's use that as an example. Radar pulses, where I'm transmitting pulses that are 1 microsecond long, and I've got a certain number of pulses per second, and a certain number of milliamps or volts is actual waveform. On an oscilloscope, that would be easy to display. To figure out whether or not I'm using the right amount of settings of the controls on that radar, and I've only got a meter like this ballistic galvanometer, I could figure out the area under the curve by how much the needle deflects. And therefore, I could either set the radar to draw twice a... I could set the radar to draw twice as much current for half the amount of time, or vice versa. So it's giving you the area under the curve up to a certain point. Now, if I use that ballistic galvanometer, and let's assume now that it goes up as high as 300 milliamps, and if I put 300 milliamps into it continuously, I would watch the needle slowly come up and asymptotically approach 300 milliamps. And so if I was now trying to compare 300 milliamps for, let's say, 10 seconds versus 300 milliamps for 100 seconds, I'd come up with almost the exact same reading. So it gives you a nice integration up to a certain period of time, depending on the time constant of the needle. So it was popular back in the days when you didn't have an oscilloscope and you want to find out the area under the curve of a particular waveform. That's what a ballistic galvanometer basically did. And some of them, made by the Weston Company and others, are rather nice, precise pieces of instrumentation, rather beautiful to look at, if you know what I mean. In 2XJN, KQRIW.
Yeah, this one was made by Philips, and it does have a button on the top. It looks like it's made for the front panel, but because it is in that beautiful letterpiece, it wasn't used for that. It does have a switch. It's not a switch, it's a push button on the top of it. And I wonder what was the purpose for it. But
I don't think I've seen the one by Philips. In some cases, the push button was a release and capture type thing. In other words, you could allow the needle to come to a particular reading and press the button, and it would hold the movement in that particular position so you could take your sweet time reading it. If, for instance, you've got some kind of a variable condition going on. Some of them had a push button that did that. I'm not sure in your particular case, when you start putting current through it, either pulse current or steady state current, and try pushing and not pushing the button, you'll eventually find out. It sure would be nice if the owner's manual was inside the case, but I know that's rare. Rarely when you buy a used piece of equipment does it come with the owner's manual. Since you've got the model number, and since the internet these days is so good at providing information, I think there's a good chance you can eventually get the owner's manual. And even if you can't find it directly on the internet, there are various user groups or listserv groups. For instance, if that was a piece of microwave equipment, and if I signed into the microwave list of WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, where he's got roughly 400, 500 people on that list, and probably in about 30 countries, and I asked somebody, hey, this piece of microwave equipment made by Raytheon, model number so-and-so, does anybody have the manual on that, or the specifications? And you get all kinds of answers. So out there somewhere, there is the information by which you'll eventually get the owner's manual, or at least find out what that button does. But I think with your own experiments, you'll find it. If I know you, you probably bought a couple of other things. Over to you, Wes, K2LIW.
A question about the Beetle, not the Beetle, the Philips. What maximum frequency this thing might go to?
One of the things that's not well known is that a galvanometer, a Dawson valve movement, that's what it really is. If I make a Dawson valve movement and if I give enough weight, enough mass to the meter movement so that it doesn't move real fast, it moves slow, it becomes an integrator. But all Dawson valve movements are an averaging meter. And the actual current flowing through the coil itself is looking at an inductance. Therefore, the meter is going to behave a little bit funny when you get beyond, let me pick a number, probably 5 or 10 megacycles, megahertz. That's a rough guess on my part. It's an averaging meter, and until you start seeing significant inductance of the coil of wire that's in the meter movement, not very much happens as a function of frequency. It still averages current. Now, if you're putting an AC current into that meter, which means your current is spending as much time positive as negative in value, then yes, the needle won't move at all. So it's not it's only the average amount of direct current that it is representing. And in your particular case, because it's got the extra mass and the ballistic galvanometer function, it's now averaging over some number of seconds. But it's always an average current meter movement is what a Dawson valve movement is. And that represents a little bit of a problem. Let me drop. Because if I was looking at a AC waveform, and I know that I cannot plug AC directly into the meter, let's assume that I had an ideal bridge rectifier that converts my AC signal into a full wave rectified AC signal. That would be, in the case of a 60 cycle waveform coming out of my 6.3 volt winding of a filament transformer, if the ideal current rating bridge rectifier was doing its job, because there are 60 cycles, and each cycle has got a positive half and a negative half, and the full-wave bridge rectifier takes the negative half and flips it back up to the positive half, if I looked at the waveform coming out of the bridge rectifier on a oscilloscope, I would see 120 pulses per second from a 60-cycle waveform, 120 pulses. Each one of them would look like a half sine function. And now I could plug that rectified, full-wave rectified waveform into the meter, and it would correctly give me the average current. Let me drop. And that's a little bit of a problem. It's not reading the peak current, it's reading the average current. In the case of a full-wave rectified waveform, average current is not true RMS current. Average current is 63%. Of the peak voltage, true RMS is 70.7%. So there's almost 7 or 8% of error. So you have to know that the needle is measuring average current, not RMS current. RMS is a more complicated mathematical function. And the reason why you want to know RMS current is because if you're taking that waveform, like a 6.3 volt winding of a transformer, and feeding it into the filament of a cathode ray tube, it's the true RMS voltage that determines the amount of heating of a resistor or a filament or whatever. So when you're measuring voltage and you're measuring current of a AC waveform, and you're going to take the product of the two to figure out how many watts you're putting into that resistor, you want to know true RMS current and true RMS voltage, not average current and average voltage. You'll end up with a low number if you just look at the average. There are meters like the Hewlett-Packard 400 AC voltmeter, vacuum tube voltmeter, let me drop it, which is using a Dawson Bell movement on the front panel. But what they have done is to recalibrate the meter. They moved all the numbers on the screen so that even though the meter is reading average, the numbers you read off the meter are RMS, root mean square, heating value, so to speak. But there's a catch. That's only true because of the way they calibrate it for a sinusoidal smooth waveform. You put a triangular waveform or a square waveform into that meter, and it's no longer read the correct number. And that's one other nice thing to know. If I'm putting a square waveform into that averaging meter, that's the one place where RMS and average are the same. A square waveform, the RMS voltage and the true RMS voltage and the average voltage happen to be the same. But in the case of a sine wave, it's not. Looks like we're going to be getting a little bit of a problem tonight. I'll turn it over to you, Wes, and we'll see if I'm able to hear you above this guy. N2XJN, KQLIW in the TechNet. That person was S3 on my input. I'm also hearing WA2VJS on the input. I'll be turning it over to you in a second. So, unfortunately, we didn't hear too much of what Wesley said on that particular transmission. See, Wes, was that the last person? Yes, he was. WA2VJS, go right ahead with your question. I hope you got a PL turned on. Let me do a quick check here. Oh, looks like the machine doesn't require a PL tone during this TechNet. So the A2VJ has thought of your name, sir, and then your question or comment. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, sir, this is Vito, WA2PJF here in Bay Shore. I thought you had made mention, a question as to whom had visited and gone to the Hamfest today, and I had gone myself. I just thought you were inquiring as to what each person found or was it worth its effort. I thought I heard that. Maybe I'm wrong. I have no other questions. So back to you, Dick.
You heard correctly, Vito. And because of the noise, I didn't get your call. That is correct. I should have recognized your voice right away. Okay, so looks like Bayshore was well represented at the flea market at Briarcliff College. How many vendors? What did you see? Was the weather good? And how much money did you spend, Vito? So the A2PJF, that's the Pilot Jet Fighters, PJF. You got it, Vito, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. Every time I go, I bring a considerable amount of money, between $1,000 and $2,000 on the average. Shouldn't be saying it over the air, but I have been to Hamfest in the past where I've had about $100 in my pocket, which was very foolish, and did see many things that I could not purchase. So I overcame that by having greater buying power. Bought a vintage, an old Hammond HQ 120 receiver for $100. The large metal speaker for 40, which wasn't too bad. The receiver was in pristine condition. I was overwhelmed in and out. So I picked that up. And then connectors and knobs and whatever, you know, nickel and dime things. And it was very fascinating. Many vendors, I can, with all due respect to those listening, I can safely say about 50% of the items that were being sold was really nothing of any great value, a lot of junk, if I use that language. But there were a few things of interest there, yes. And many vendors, and very exciting. The weather was nice, clear, warm. It was perfect, absolutely. So back to you, Dick. This is WA2PJF.
B2BHY with a handset.
Okay, we're going to get to Jim after Vito. Hey, Vito, sounds like you had a good time. And that is a classic, the Hamelin HQ 120, 129X, 160, 180. There's a whole series of them. But in its day, that was a Cadillac. Sounds like you got one in very good, pristine condition. And there are guys who just love collecting antique radios. And a tube-type radio that Hamelin probably still has more dynamic range to it, can tolerate strong nearby signals compared to some of the more modern solid-state equipment. So it sounds like you had a good time. And when it comes to flea markets and junk, you got to be careful now. Junk is in the eye of the beholder. Let me drop. I mean, one of the best things that I ever bought was a piece of microwave equipment. This was a 20-decibel waveguide directional coupler made from 8 to 12 gigahertz. And because of its very elaborate internal construction made by the Alfred Company, it probably cost, you know, $5,000 and was brand new. I bought it for $2, and in the particular basket it was in this flea market up in Massachusetts, in New Hampshire, it was dusty and dirty, and it really looked like junk. But to a person who knows what he's looking at, took it home, cleaned it up, and had an awful lot of fun with that thing. It is so accurate in its directivity that it makes a radar, a one-component radar, if you know what I mean. So the word junk is very relative. It's in the eye of the beholder. Depends on what you're looking for, and if you know what you're looking at, if you know what I mean. Directional couplers in general, an awful lot of people will turn their nose up at them because they don't know what they are. Some of them look pretty dirty and grungy and so on. You clean them up, and unless they've really been abused, like being dropped on the floor and internal things have been broken, they're worth their weight in gold, in my opinion. And even if it's been dropped on the floor and has an internal breakage or something, as John has experienced, by taking it apart and properly reassembling it, soldering it back together, restoring it to full operation is rather easy. So those are some good words on that. Jim, sounds like you went to the flea market. Maybe you found another battery for your radio, and what did you see there? What did you buy? KD2BHY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Jason, DTZ also went.
DTZ, I think it is. We'll get to you in a second. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi, thanks, Dick. I made out pretty well for the Hamfest. It was a perfect day. It was a really nice day. And I had about $40 on me. And I came out with stuff that's much more than $40. I got a free antenna. It's a 144 megahertz, 70 centimeter ground plane with a little coil in the middle. And the guy just gave it to me for free. He must have not been using it. He just said, "Here, have this." So I took that and thanked him. And another thing I got, the main thing that I bought, was a Kenwood TR7930. It's a 2-meter FM transceiver. It has no PL, but it does 25 watts. And I think I'm going to have a lot of fun with this thing because it just looks cool. And I have the power supply and everything else except the mic. And the mic looks like it's going to be pretty easy to find. I also won one of the raffles. I got the 2012-2013 repeater directory in a raffle. So I was pretty, it was a pretty good Hamfest for me.
Yeah, I can tell, Jim, you lucked out. The price is right. For a free antenna on 2 meters and 432 or 440, the rig that you bought, the TR7930, 25 watts, FM, and the directory. Hey, you made out like a bandit. And I should also thank Vito. He's mailed me some very nice information about the Titanic radio system. And boy, that radio saved an awful lot of lives, even though it was a very primitive radio by modern day standards, a spark transmitter on the Titanic. But nobody would have known to come and rescue those people that did survive. Lots of people survived, even though a lot of them died. So the maritime people rapidly discovered there better be a radio on every single passenger ship from then on, and there better be a 24-hour service of the radio operator and his crew to make sure emergencies can be handled. Okay, I only got the suffix of the other person who wants to tell us what he saw at the flea market. Delta Tango Zulu, I think it was. Give me your full call letter, sir, and your name, and then proceed. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
K2RIW, K6DPZ, name is Al. I can't stand very fast, Dick, but I did it very well. Clegg 22er for $20, Gonsett Sidewinder for $80. Those are the main things. An 8601 HP suite generator for $75. So I was happy camper at the flea market. That's my thing, Dick. I can't stay in, but I wanted to tell you. And also, will you explain, there was a question about linear to capacity, linear to frequency, variable capacitors. And I was talking to one of your good buddies there, and I was trying to explain it to him. Maybe you can give him a critique on it. My English is not that good. Go ahead. K2RIW, K6DPC.
WB2CUK.
Okay, Mr. CUK recognized. And Bill's a flea market man from way back, so I'm guaranteeing he's going to be telling us what he saw today. Sounds like you've got some more classic equipment there, Hal. Also, I think Jim visited your museum on one occasion, saw both your outback building and the in-house building, and saw lots and lots of radios. So apparently you really got a huge collection, according to Jim's report. Is there an easy way of making a variable capacitor? Yeah, it looks like a logarithmic taper. There's a kind of air variable capacitor where the rotary vanes have a very weird shape to them, such that as you turn it in the direction that increases the capacitance increases much more rapidly near the end than it does in the beginning. And when you set up those ratios just right, and that's the capacitor across the coil that's determining the frequency of a variable frequency oscillator. Let me drop. And you get a linear turning in degrees of the capacitor versus the frequency in megacycles. Since frequency of an LC circuit follows the equation 1 over 2 pi square root of LC, if the 1 over 2 pi, that's a constant, the square root of L, since we're not changing the inductor, that's a constant, and therefore the only thing that's changing is the C. But the C is inside the square root sign. So you want the capacitor to change in such a way that it's a square law function of capacitance versus degrees of rotation, such that it takes that square root function out of the equation and backs it back out, so to speak. So by setting up a variable capacitor plate with that crazy shape, you can make them linear in capacitance versus turning of the dial. That's what I think is Hal is asking about. Let's see what Bill's got to say. What did you see at that flea market today, Bill? It'll be B2CUK. And boy, you're going to have things to talk about tomorrow night. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Dick, WB2CUK. I just want to say that young fellow bought my radio there, the 7930. So I'm sure I'll get a lot of enjoyment with that. I had it on the air a little while here. I'm sorry I didn't have a mic for it, but those mics at the 5 pence are kind of hard to find. I picked up a lot of interesting things, a Yaesu memorizer, a CB with weather band, and the prize, I guess, is the MFJ shortwave receiver, one of these super regen receivers. And it had a battery in it. I put the headphones on and an antenna, and the thing was picking up, and I'm really amazed. I had a good time at the Ham Fest. I'm glad we had good weather. A lot of nice bargains to be had. And, I'll be talking a little bit on the Swap and Chop. And there's an auction next week in Sukasauna, the Split Rock Amateur Radio Club's having an auction, plus the Hall of Science. And I guess it conflicts with Lime Rock's picnic, but what can I say? Dick, back over to you. I'm not going to hang out. I got other people here. We're playing radio tonight, but just thought I'd chime in there. WB2CUK is clear.
Intuition.
Bill, your Super Regen receiver, what frequency does it operate on?
3.62, I guess about 30. It's in five bands. And the only problem was that the non-